Matt Taibbi frames his campaign reporting with original essays that explore the seismic shift in how we perceive our national institutions, the democratic process, and the future of the country. Not just a post-mortem on the collapse and failure of American democracy, his new book, Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus, offers a darkly comic, riveting, surreal, unique, and essential experience of seeing the future in hindsight. Matt Taibbi is author of the New York Times bestsellers The Divide, Griftopia, and The Great Derangement. He is a contributing editor of Rolling Stone and winner of the 2008 National Magazine Award for Columns and Commentary. Again, the name of the new book, Insane Clown President. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Matt Taibbi to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
No, thanks for having me on.
Given that we are just days, hours away from the inauguration, given that you have covered this for 2 years plus, how are you feeling right now?
Anxious. I think the news of the last couple of weeks and months has added a new dimension to this story that nobody could have foreseen. I think it was already a singular, crazy episode in the history of our country, but this last detour that we've taken with the Russia angle has made this, you know, the most chaotic inauguration week I would imagine that we've ever had.
I want to bring you back, obviously, to the beginning and your following of this. But before we leave this particular subject, did you see this coming in any way, shape, or form? Meaning that since the story was out there, does this fit into the narrative of the insane nature of the campaign from the very beginning?
Absolutely. This is actually, to me, a kind of an affirmation of some theories that I had been developing kind of years ago before Trump even came onto the scene, which is that ordinary people are kind of tuning out traditional media and they're drifting in all directions increasingly towards kind of conspiratorial thinking. And they're, I think some of that is bled into the traditional media now. And I think that's fueling part of what's going on with this Russia story. You know, previously this kind of stuff was really the exclusive province of right-wing media. And now what we've had, I think, with this Russia story is we have elements of a story that are true, and then the rest of it is being fanned by this kind of gigantic internet machine that makes a bigger and scarier and more conspiratorial story out of that. To me, this is like sort of the ultimate ending to what has already been a crazy season.
When you first started reporting on this in August of 2015, which is when your first piece on the election was printed, you said the thing is, when you actually think about it, it's not funny. Do you think that was, we sort of started off with that especially with the possibility of Donald Trump running at that point, that it was a gag, it was a ruse, it was nothing more than that?
Oh yeah, no, I think that's one of the things that comes through in the book, is that in the beginning, I think a lot of people were just taking a lot of comic pleasure in how crazy this narrative was. I mean, it wasn't just Donald Trump. Remember, there was this absolutely absurd situation with 16/17 candidates, none of whom was really a serious contender for the presidency, all of whom were running these bumbling campaigns. And, you know, that clown car narrative appeared in the scene even before Donald Trump entered the race. So everybody thought it was very funny. And I think when the potential damage was limited to the short-term destruction of the Republican Party, everybody thought it was funny. It wasn't until, you know, the possibility of Trump actually becoming president became real for people, and that for some people that didn't happen until Election Day, that, you know, that the story took a much, much darker turn.
You point out in the very beginning of the book, in the first chapter, that you had written a book called The Great Derangement, and you were basically looking at middle America and middle America's growing mistrust of government, the media, and other forces. And the thesis of the book being that we are moving toward a future in which facts would be increasingly irrelevant and people would gravitate more and more toward conspiratorial politics. As you started to cover campaign 2016, did you see that from the get-go, or did you see that slowly evolve as time went on?
No, I saw that right from the start. I mean, I had been kind of waiting for something like Trump to happen for a long time. I definitely wouldn't claim that I saw Donald Trump in particular coming, but the, you know, the problem of ordinary people tuning out the national political media, that was something that I'd seen starting 10 years ago. I remember trying to talk to people about the Iraq War and, you know, trying to explain to them that there was no connection, for instance, between Saddam Hussein and the hijackers, and they just wouldn't believe it, no matter what evidence that you tried to show them. The idea that we were being tuned out, the political media, and distrusted, and that we were becoming villains in this kind of growing conservative narrative, that was something that was pretty obvious to everybody who does this for a living, dating back a couple of campaigns now. And it just happened to get a lot worse this time around. And the moment I think that it really crystallized was when Trump said those things about John McCain, and traditionally that would have been the end for any candidate. That when the press ganged up on him and he didn't disappear and people didn't denounce him and he didn't go down on the polls, that was really, you know, a signal for all of us.
You talk about one of the lines in the first chapter is, gone will be the good old days of neat blue state, red state hatred, a nicely symmetrical storyline that has always appealed to the crossfire American gladiators sports coverage mentality of the commercial media. And although Trump had that very us versus them idea at the beginning, didn't he?
He did, but it was a different us and a different them. So, you know, Trump had a couple of key innovations. The one was that the campaign was just a big television show, and he was going to take it from being a bad and a boring television show to one that was really engrossing and you know, that you couldn't miss. And the other one was that he was going to wreck all these stereotypes. In the old days, we had very careful lanes that Republican and Democratic candidates were supposed to stay in, particularly in terms of, like, each side, for instance, would blame certain villains for problems. They would stand up in front of voters and say, here's the reason that things are bad in your life right now. And for Republicans, that was foreigners, that was immigrants, that was liberal professors. They had a whole list of bogeymen. And on the left, you know, there was a different set of miscreants who were always being pointed at, and that was, you know, corporations, the military-industrial complex, et cetera, et cetera, Wall Street. Trump appropriated all of those villains for himself. He made it really more about, you know, it's us against all of these people in Washington, left and right, both parties. They're both in on it, and we're all on the outside. And I'm a traitor to that class, and I'm going to help you, the people, overcome this conspiracy of elites that's at the top. So he broke the whole script of Republicans versus Democrats, and he kind of postulated that this was a false narrative, and people bought it. And you know, and there's probably some truth to it.
Matt Taibbi is our guest. The name of the new book is Insane Clown President: Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. The book is published by Random House. When you think about the campaign, the Republican campaign, and as you mentioned, 16, 17 candidates, in your opinion, was there a quote-unquote normal one?
On the Republican side?
Yes.
Sure. There were people who in the past would have been the presumptive front runners and might even have succeeded. I think Jeb Bush was set up to be that person. Scott Walker could easily have been that person. You might even imagine that somebody like Ted Cruz or even Marco Rubio. I think Marco Rubio was somebody who certainly the press all thought was going to end up being the person because Rubio in person, he checks all the boxes for traditional political reporters. He's a dynamic performer in events. He knows all of his lines. He's got a little bit of personal magnetism to him. And of course, he's completely in tune with what all of the donors on the Republican side want. And so this, he had the look of somebody who was going to be a future presidential nominee. It just didn't work out that way. The voters had an idea that they were going to get something different this time, and Rubio did not seem different. I think the end for him really came in those New Hampshire debates when he repeated his lines, which identified him as a traditional kind of fake politician, and Trump exploited that.
Do you think if there had been some cohesion, if the party had stepped in and said, look, one of you has to take on this guy and let's look at it and say it's one against one as opposed to one against 13, 12, 11, 10 as the field got whittled down, would that have worked?
It might have if there had been a setup like the Democrats had on their side, right, you know, where it was really just one candidate against another candidate. That might have helped because Trump clearly in the beginning only had a plurality. He didn't have a majority of support on the Republican side. And they very, I think, incautiously allowed too large of a field to continue on past Iowa and New Hampshire, which basically guaranteed a victory for Trump because his support was really insoluble. If they had done that, that might have helped. But if you look at what happened with the person that they put all their chips on, that was Jeb Bush, who had $100 million really from the start of this campaign and could not, you know, really get himself past double digits in the polls at any time. That spoke to an enormous disconnect between what the Republican Party thought was going to happen and what the voters actually wanted. And there's a long, you know, narrative about what they believed the next Republican candidate, what policies that person had to espouse, and that's why they picked Jeb. They wanted somebody who was more liberal on immigration, and it turned out the voters were thinking something very different.
As you point out in the book, it seemed that all along the way, certainly in the primary and then in the general election, but certainly during the primary, that Republicans and individual candidates just assumed that Donald Trump would go away, that would be a problem that would take care of itself. He would say something outrageous, he would get bumped, and he would move on.
Right. That's because that's what has always happened. We have this kind of system. I talk about it in the book. I call it the seal of death. This is something that reporters on the trail talk about, which is that traditionally when a candidate has stepped out of bounds, the press basically descends upon the candidate like piranhas and they tear that person to pieces and that person is never really heard or seen from again. If you look back in history, it happens over and over again when somebody has a misstep, you know, Howard Dean with his scream or Gary Hart getting caught with the, you know, the monkey business photo. Once something like that happens, traditionally the national political media just goes to work on the person. There's a plunge in the polls. The next step is a humiliating public apology. Shortly after that is the exit. This is the script we've always followed. And I think everybody assumed that was what was going to happen with Trump. The problem is that our power to kind of wipe out candidates at will had vanished, and we just weren't aware of it until Trump continued to persist this time around. And that was a big signal to me that he was going to stick around and that he wasn't just going to go away. I think a lot of our people in the media were deluded about that.
Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, you had Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Obviously, the rise of Bernie Sanders was a huge story as well. Do you think that was as easy to predict?
No. I didn't see that coming as much. And I obviously have a bit of a relationship with Bernie Sanders. I've known him for a long time and admired him, which is one of the reasons I tried not to cover his campaign as much. But I think what happened with Bernie was similar to what was going on the Trump side. You had an electorate that was growing steadily disenfranchised from the two major political parties, and they wanted something starkly different. And the problem with Hillary Clinton, and of course there are a lot of people who are fans of Hillary Clinton who are going to disagree with this, but her main issue was that she had been around for a long time. She wasn't new. And the voters wanted somebody who was a quote-unquote outsider. And Trump was more of an outsider than Bernie Sanders, but Sanders is also, you know, to a significant degree, not a traditional Democrat. And I think that really fueled a lot of the enthusiasm for him. The difference was, of course, that Bernie Sanders wasn't a free coverage machine the way that Donald Trump was. He got like 23 times less coverage on television. So that was a huge factor early in the campaign.
Writing in June of 2016 about when Hillary Clinton had pretty much clinched it, you said Democrats will learn all the wrong lessons from their brush with Bernie. Instead of a reality check for the party, it'll be smugness redoubled. And that's exactly what happened. So at what point did we look at this and say, okay, they're not going to learn their lesson?
Well, I think we can still say that about them. I mean, if you look at the reaction after the election, all you heard about was that Russia was to blame. The press hadn't gone after Donald Trump enough.
Comey
was to blame. And you know, they, if not for a few tactical errors, they would have won this election. They won the popular vote. Whereas the reality is, against a candidate like Donald Trump, the fact that it was even close, the fact that they, you know, that Trump was even within 10 million votes of the Democratic candidate, should have been, you know, a horrible wake-up call for everybody. I mean, the idea of losing a popularity contest to somebody like Trump, who was just totally unsuited for office and just said these horrible, outrageous things that really discredited him with all of the major demographic groups, they should be shocked. They should be reeling right now and thinking, oh my God, what do we have to do to rehabilitate ourselves with ordinary people? But the problem is, and this is something that I talk about in the book, is that the two political parties are both set up to be kind of insulated from reality. They don't really have a whole lot of contact with actual voters. So they're not really engaged in the mood out there. And so they were surprised, I think, not only by Trump's rise, but by the rise of Sanders and by the lack of enthusiasm for their candidate.
You wrote in September about Donald Trump losing his mojo, flailing on race and immigration, his campaign in chaos. The candidate who made a brilliant farce of the election is now finding the joke is on him. How did he work around that?
This is where I made my big mistake covering Donald Trump, because I was, up until this point, I think I had a pretty good sense of what was going on, and I never thought it was going to be anybody but him as the nominee. I wasn't surprised when he won. I thought he had a good chance against Hillary Clinton. You know, pretty late in the game, I think, up until about March or April, I thought he was going to be a contender. And then what happened was, they changed tactics, and the sort of unscripted, off the cuff, insane Donald Trump started on the campaign trail anyway, to be replaced by this scripted, stilted, kind of mechanized Donald Trump that they were using to try to communicate this really bizarre message about how he was going to be the rescuer of the African American community. And I thought this was a disaster. I had no idea what they were doing, and I thought it would reduce enthusiasm with the base. Instead, it turned out to do exactly what they set out to do, which was rehabilitate his image with, you know, quote unquote mainstream Republicans who didn't want to think of themselves as racist. And they ended up recapturing, you know, basically the entire Republican coalition that way. And I took it as a mistake. It turned out to be the most brilliant move of his campaign.
Let's talk about where we started off with, which was the Russia situation. Given what we know now, and given what is, we don't know the whole story, obviously, but we know more than we did. And you hear someone like John Lewis say, this man is an illegitimate president.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that statement?
I wouldn't want to disagree with somebody like John Lewis, but I think there's a conundrum here for people who are in the media business, which is there at times is a gap between what we can report and what you might believe, what you might think, what you might guess at. In this case, with the Russia story, all that we've really seen so far are, you know, analyses by people who are pretty good at the cyber detection business, making what they insist is a very compelling case that the Russians hacked the DNC, along with similar assessments that they probably turned it over to WikiLeaks. But beyond that, You know, there's a huge, there's an order of magnitude difference between Russia meddling with the DNC and the election and to that degree and Trump being in on it, you know, and there being this Manchurian candidate kind of a plot, which I think is what's being implied a lot in the news right now. And I don't know that we can really say that with any confidence until we see something. I certainly look at the dossier that's been published. And, you know, from my experience living in Russia, I was there for 11 years, you know, what that dossier describes is a Russian intelligence community that's like a, you know, a high school cafeteria where everybody can hear what they're saying. I just don't believe it, you know, that there would be that many leaks and disclosures out there. So it's hard to know.
Do you think that as we look at this, that ultimately you investigate it, but then we have to get over it eventually and just say, okay, Donald Trump will be the president on Friday and then go from there?
Well, I think what you said first is the most important thing, which is that there has to be an urgent bipartisan investigation, because the concept that even if it's a remote possibility that he's somehow compromised and under the power of a foreign government that's hostile to our interests, you know, that would be an unparalleled disaster in the history of our democracy. And if there's any truth to that at all, you know, we have to get to the bottom of it and make sure that it doesn't happen and that there are impeachment proceedings. However, if at the end of that investigation it turns out that he is just the, you know, kind of unthinking, idiotic beneficiary of Putin's geopolitical whimsy, then everybody's got to get over it and just say this guy is our president and apply pressure to him not to be in Putin's clutches. And that's all we can really do, I think.
Mm. Two-pronged question about the media. How do you believe overall the media did in covering this story? And because there is a line in the book about blowing off the warning signs of a Trump presidency. So I'm interested in that. And also, how do you believe the relationship should change between the media and this president?
Well, I've been critical of the political media and the campaign media for a long time, you know, ever since I first started doing this, you know, back in 2000, 2004. I've always been really troubled by the fact that the campaign is basically this kind of traveling prison. It's where the press is really trapped with the candidate and his or her aides at all times, and they really only interact with each other. And they don't really, you crisscross the country tens of thousands of miles during the campaign, but you don't really see the country at all and listen to people, except for a few minutes at a time at these events. And so what happens is you have the cream of the political media not really in tune with what's going out there, going on out there in the country. And that's how, you know, this situation, there's just an enormous amount of pain, you know, in what you would call flyover America. You know, people are not only suffering economically, there are these incredible crises that go undetected in places like Washington and New York, you know, opiate addiction, suicide, alcoholism at unbelievable levels. And that somehow was missed going into this election. People just weren't cognizant of it. You can't do this job through polls and, you know, a few meet and greets. You have to actually talk to people, and that is a huge failing in our media. We just don't do that enough, and so that was a problem. And then going forward, in terms of how you deal with Trump, I just think you have to do the job. You know, I mean, that it's not so much that you have to be negative about him; it's that you just have to do the work and be accurate. I think what ultimately undermines the media and people's faith in the media is when we make mistakes and when we overreach, when we're too political on either side. I think that's what happened to the conservative media this time. They thought that they could stop Trump too. You know, you think about the National Review doing a 20-part series on why you shouldn't vote for Trump, and everybody on that side tuned them out. So these are all lessons for us. You know, I think we just got to stick to doing what we do, which is report the facts and be aggressive about it, and try to stay out of the other end of the pool, which is the politics part of it.
You do write at the end of the book, it's too late for any of us to fix this colossal misread and lapse in professional caution. Now all we can do is wait to see how much of this failure of vision will cost the public that we supposedly serve. Just like the politicians, our job was to listen and we talked instead. Now America will do its own talking for a while. The world may never forgive us for not seeing this coming. How do you believe over the next 4 years we will pay the price?
Well, I mean, it's the range of possibilities with Trump and what his presidency could be are so enormous that it's impossible to really to guess. The only thing we know concretely so far is that he's clearly brought in a lot of people who are, you know, zealots in the deregulatory area. His chief advisor is a guy, Steve Bannon, who is a kind of a nationalist, racist revolutionary, really. And so there's some very dangerous people who have already been brought into Washington. They're, you know, the government is already filled with people from companies like Goldman Sachs. You know, it's hard to say. You know, Trump seems not to have a very long attention span, and he may not be terribly interested in remaking the country according to some hideous vision like, you know, some dictators from the past. But, you know, he's got some bad ideas and he's surrounded himself with some dangerous people. So, you know, we have to brace ourselves for that.
I'm curious of what you think about, obviously, with us and public radio, we get calls and letters all the time of people saying you shouldn't cover the inauguration, you shouldn't look at the inauguration, we want to go elsewhere, put somebody else on, we can get that elsewhere. And a real turning the back to this person. Obviously, we feel as a news organization that, of course, we have to bring the inauguration of the President of the United States. With that said, how do you believe and what do you believe people should be listening for on Friday that is any different than what we have been listening to over the last 2.5 years?
Well, a presidential inauguration address, just like a State of the Union address, is really a blueprint for what policy-wise is to come. So I think you have to listen to that inauguration speech very carefully and listen to what plans are being elucidated. The only difference is that Donald Trump is somebody who changes his mind as a matter of course. So what he may believe now, he may not believe, you know, 10 minutes after the speech is over. So I don't know that we really need to listen for. I just think that we do need to pay attention to him, and even though that's what he wants. And the idea of not covering him, that might have been beneficial early in the campaign when he was getting this enormous amount of free coverage, when other politicians had to pay for their publicity. Now, I don't think it would serve anybody for us to ignore him. He's already the president, and attention actually at this point can only be a good thing. So this isn't like an early stage of the campaign where he's getting free publicity. This is now we're covering him as an executive, and I think we have to do that.
The name of the book, Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. The book is published by Spiegel & Gras. Matt Taibbi, I thank you very much for spending time with us. Thank you very much for your great writing and for all your reporting. I appreciate it.
No, thanks very much, Joe. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus by Matt Taibbi. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.